This is Audible.
Dolaire's Book of Greek Myths. In olden times, when men still worshipped ugly idols, there lived in the land of Greece a folk of shepherds and herdsmen who cherished light and beauty. They did not worship dark idols like their neighbors, but created instead their own beautiful, radiant gods. The Greek gods looked very much like people and acted like them too, only they were taller, handsomer, and could do no wrong. Fire-breathing monsters and beasts with many heads stood for all that was dark and wicked. They were for gods and great heroes to conquer. The gods lived on top of Olympus, a mountain so high and steep that no man could climb it and see them in their shining palace. But they often descended to earth, sometimes in their own shapes, sometimes disguised as humans or animals. Mortals worshipped the gods, and the gods honored Mother Earth. They had all sprung from her, for she was the beginning of all life. Gaia, the Earth, came out of darkness so long ago that nobody knows when or how. Earth was young and lonesome, for nothing lived on her yet. Above her rose Uranus, the sky, dark and blue, set all over with sparkling stars. He was magnificent to behold, and young Earth looked up at him and fell in love with him. Sky smiled down at Earth, twinkling with countless stars, and they were joined in love. Soon young Earth became Mother Earth, the mother of all things living. All her children loved their warm and bountiful mother and feared their mighty father, Uranus, Lord of the Universe.
The Titans were the first children of Mother Earth. They were the first gods, taller than the mountains she created to serve them as thrones, and both Earth and Sky were proud of them. There were six Titans, six glorious gods, and they had six sisters, the Titanesses, whom they took for their wives. When Gaia gave birth, Uranus was not proud. Their new children were also huge, but each had only one glowing eye set in the middle of his forehead. They were the three Cyclops. They were named Lightning, Thunder, and Thunderbolt. They were not handsome gods, but tremendously strong smiths. Sparks from their heavy hammers flashed across the sky and lit up the heavens so brightly that even their father's stars faded. After a while, Mother Earth bore three more sons. Uranus looked at them with disgust. Each of them had 50 heads and 100 strong arms. He hated to see such ugly creatures walk about on lovely Earth, so he seized them and their brothers the Cyclops and flung them into Tartarus, the deepest, darkest pit under the Earth. Mother Earth loved her children and could not forgive her husband for his cruelty to them. Out of the hardest flint, she fashioned a sickle and spoke to her sons, the Titans. Take this weapon and make an end to your father's cruelty and set your brothers free. Fear took hold of five of the Titans, and they trembled and refused. Only Cronus, the youngest but strongest, dared to take the sickle. He fell upon his father. Uranus could not withstand the weapon wielded by his strong son, and he fled, giving up his powers. Mother Earth made Pontus, the boundless sea, her second husband, and from this union sprang the gods of the watery depths. And from her rich ground grew an abundance of trees and flowers, and out of her crevices sprites, beasts, and early man crept forth. Cronus was now Lord of the Universe. He sat on the highest mountain and ruled over heaven and earth with a firm hand. The other gods obeyed his will, and early man worshipped him. This was man's golden age. Men lived happily and in peace with the gods and each other. They did not kill, and they had no locks on their doors, for theft had not yet been invented. But Cronus did not set his monstrous brothers free, and Mother Earth was angry with him and plotted his downfall. She had to wait, for no god yet born was strong enough to oppose him. But she knew that one of his sons would be stronger than he, just as Cronus had been stronger than his father. Cronus knew it too, so every time his titaness wife, Rhea, gave birth, he took the newborn god and swallowed it. With all of his offspring securely inside him, he had nothing to fear. But Rhea mourned. Her five sisters, who had married the five other titans, were surrounded by their titan children, while she was all alone. When Rhea expected her sixth child, she asked Mother Earth to help her save the child from his father. This was just what Mother Earth had been waiting for. She gave her daughter whispered advice, and Rhea went away smiling. As soon as Rhea had borne her child, the god Zeus, she hid him. Then she wrapped a stone in baby clothes and gave it to her husband to swallow instead of her son. Cronus was fooled and swallowed the stone, and the little god Zeus was spirited away to a secret cave on the island of Crete. Old Cronus never heard the cries of his young son, for Mother Earth set noisy earth sprites outside the cave. They made such a clatter, beating their shields with their swords, that other sounds were drowned out.
Zeus was tended by gentle nymphs and was nursed by the fairy goat Amalthea. From the horns of the goat flowed ambrosia and nectar, the food and drink of the gods. Zeus grew rapidly, and it was not long before he strode out of the cave as a great new god. To thank the nymphs for tending him so well, he gave them the horns of the goat. They were horns of plenty and could never be emptied. From the hide of the goat he made for himself an impenetrable breastplate, the Aegis, and now he was so strong that Cronus could do nothing against him. Young Zeus chose Metis, a titan's daughter, for his first wife. She was the goddess of prudence, and he needed her good advice. She warned him not to try alone to overthrow the child-devouring father, for Cronus had all the other titans and their sons on his side. First, Zeus must also have strong allies. Metis went to Cronus and cunningly tricked him into eating a magic herb. He thought that the herb would make him unconquerable. Instead, it made him so sick that he vomited up not only the stone he had swallowed, but his five other children as well. They were the gods Hades and Poseidon, and the goddesses Hestia, Demeter, and Hera, all mighty gods who right away joined forces with Zeus. When Cronus saw the six young gods rising against him, he knew that his hour had come, and he surrendered his powers and fled. Now Zeus was the lord of the universe. He did not want to rule alone. He shared his powers with his brothers and sisters. But the Titans and their sons revolted. They refused to let themselves be ruled by the new gods. Only Prometheus and his brother Epimetheus left the Titans to join Zeus, for Prometheus could look into the future and he knew that Zeus would win. Zeus freed the monstrous sons of Mother Earth from Tartarus. Gratefully, the hundred-armed ones fought for him with all their strength, and the Cyclops forged mighty weapons for him and his brothers. They made a trident for Poseidon. It was so forceful that when he struck the ground with it, the earth shook, and when he struck the sea, frothing waves stood mountains high. For Hades, they made a cap of invisibility so that he could strike his enemies unseen, and for Zeus, they forged lightning bolts. Armed with them, he was the mightiest god of all. Nothing could stand against him and his thunderbolts. The Titans fought a bitter battle, but at last they had to surrender, and Zeus locked them up in Tartarus. The 100 armed monsters went to stand guard at the gates to see that they never escaped. Atlas, the strongest of the Titans, was sent to the end of the world to carry forever the vault of the sky on his shoulders. Angry with Zeus for sending her sons, the Titans, into the dark pit of Tartarus, Mother Earth now brought forth two terrible monsters, Typhon and his mate Echidna, and sent them against Zeus. They were so fearful that when the gods saw them, they changed themselves into animals and fled in terror. Typhon's 100 horrible heads touched the stars. Venom dripped from evil eyes, and lava and red-hot stones poured from his gaping mouths. Hissing like 100 snakes and roaring like 100 lions, he tore up whole mountains and threw them at the gods. Zeus soon regained his courage and turned, and when the other gods saw him taking his stand, they came back to help him fight the monster. A terrible battle raged, and hardly a living creature was left on earth. But Zeus was fated to win, and as Typhon tore up huge Mount Etna to hurl at the gods, Zeus struck it with 100 well-aimed thunderbolts, and the mountain fell back, pinning Typhon underneath. There the monster lies to this very day, belching fire, lava, and smoke through the top of the mountain. Echidna, his hideous mate, escaped destruction. She cowered in a cave, protecting Typhon's dreadful offspring, and Zeus let them live as a challenge to future heroes. Now, at last, Mother Earth gave up her struggle. There were no more upheavals, and the wounds of the war soon healed. The mountains stood firmly anchored, the seas had their shores, the rivers had their riverbeds, and the ox-horned river gods watched over them, and each tree and each spring had its nymph. The earth again was green and fruitful, and Zeus could begin to rule in peace. The one-eyed Cyclops were not only smiths, but masons as well, and they built a towering palace for the gods on top of Mount Olympus, the highest mountain in Greece. The palace was hidden in clouds, and the goddesses of the seasons rolled them away whenever a god wanted to go down to earth. Nobody else could pass through the gate of clouds. Iris, the fleet-footed messenger of the gods, had her own path down to earth. Dressed in a gown of iridescent drops, she ran along the rainbow on her busy errands between Olympus and Earth.
In the gleaming hall of the palace, where light never failed, the Olympian gods sat on 12 golden thrones and reigned over heaven and earth. There were 12 great gods, for Zeus shared his powers not only with his brothers and sisters, but with 6 of his children and the goddess of love as well. Zeus himself sat on the highest throne, with a bucketful of thunderbolts beside him. On his right sat his youngest sister, Hera, whom he had chosen from all of his wives as his queen. Beside her sat her son, Ares, god of war, and Hephaestus, god of fire, with Aphrodite, goddess of love, between them. Next was Zeus's son Hermes, the herald of the gods, and Zeus's sister Demeter, goddess of the harvest, with her daughter Persephone on her lap. On the left of Zeus sat his brother Poseidon, the lord of the sea. Next to him sat the 4 children of Zeus, Athena, the twins Apollo and Artemis, and Dionysus, the youngest of the gods. Athena was the goddess of wisdom, Apollo the god of light and music, Artemis, goddess of the hunt, and Dionysus, the god of wine. Hestia, the eldest sister of Zeus, was goddess of the hearth. She had no throne, but tended the sacred fire in the hall, and every hearth on earth was her altar. She was the gentlest of all the Olympians. Hades, the eldest brother of Zeus, was the lord of the dead. He preferred to stay in his gloomy palace in the underworld, and never went to Olympus. The gods themselves could not die, for divine ichor flowed in their veins instead of blood. Most of the time they lived happily together, feasting on sweet-smelling ambrosia and nectar. But when their wills clashed, there were violent quarrels. Then Zeus would reach for a thunderbolt, and the Olympians would tremble and fall to order, for Zeus alone was stronger than all the other gods together.
Hera, the beautiful queen of Olympus, was a very jealous wife. Even Zeus, who was afraid of nothing, feared her fits of temper. She hated all his other wives, and when Zeus first asked her to be his wife, she refused. Slyly, Zeus created a thunderstorm, changed himself into a cuckoo bird, and pretending to be in distress, he flew into Hera's arms for protection. She pitied the wet little bird and hugged it close to keep it warm. But all of a sudden, she found herself holding mighty Zeus in her arms instead of a bird. Thus Zeus won Hera, and all nature burst into bloom for their wedding. Mother Earth gave the bride a little apple tree that bore golden apples of immortality. Hera treasured the tree and planted it in the garden of the Hesperides, her secret garden far to the west. She put a 100-headed dragon under the tree to guard the apples and ordered the 3 nymphs of the Hesperides to water and care for the tree. Zeus loved Hera dearly, but he was also very fond of rocky Greece. He often sneaked down to Earth in disguise to marry mortal girls. The more wives he had, the more children he would have, and all the better for Greece. All his children would inherit some of his greatness and become great heroes and rulers. But Hera, in her jealous rage, tormented his other wives and children, and even Zeus was powerless to stop her. She knew how tricky Zeus could be, and she kept a very close watch over him. One day, as Hera looked down on Earth, she spied a small dark thundercloud where no cloud should have been. She rushed down and darted into the cloud. Zeus was there, just as she suspected, but with him was only a little snow-white cow. He had seen Hera coming, and to protect his newest bride, Io, from her wrath, he had changed the girl into a cow. Alas, the cow was as lovely as the girl, and Hera was not deceived. But she pretended to suspect nothing, and begged Zeus to let her have the dainty cow. Zeus could not well refuse his queen such a little wish without giving himself away, and he had to give her the cow. Hera tied poor Io to a tree and sent her servant Argos to keep watch over her. Argos had 100 bright eyes placed all over his body. He was so big and strong that single-handedly he had made an end to the monstrous Echidna, who had lived in a cave and had devoured all who passed by. He was Hera's faithful servant and the best of watchmen, for he never closed more than half his eyes in sleep at a time. Argos sat down next to the cow and watched her with all his eyes. And poor Io had to walk on 4 legs and eat grass. She raised her mournful eyes to Olympus, but Zeus was so afraid of Hera, he did not dare to help her. At last, he could no longer bear to see her distress, and he asked his son, Hermes, the craftiest of the gods, to run down to Earth and set Io free. Hermes disguised himself as a shepherd and walked up to Argos, playing a tune on his shepherd's pipe. Argos was bored, having nothing to do with all his eyes but watch a little cow, and he was glad to have music and company. Hermes sat down beside him, and after he'd played for a while, he began to tell a long and dull story. It had no beginning, and it had no end, and 50 of Argos's eyes closed in sleep. Hermes droned on, and slowly the 50 other eyes fell shut, one by one. Quickly Hermes touched all the eyes with his magic wand and closed them forever in eternal sleep. Argos had been bored to death. Hermes then untied the cow, and Io ran home to her father, the river god Inachos. He did not recognize the cow as his daughter, and Io could not tell him what had happened. All she could say was, "Moo!" But when she lifted up her little hoof and scratched her name, I, O, in the river sand, her father at once understood what had happened, for he knew the ways of Zeus. Inachus rose out of his riverbed and rushed off to take revenge on the mighty thunder god. He flew at Zeus in such a rage that to save himself, Zeus had to throw a thunderbolt, and ever since, the bed of the river Inachus in Arcadia has been dry. Hera was furious when she saw that Argos was dead and the cow Io had been set free. She sent a vicious gadfly to sting and chase the cow. To be sure that her faithful servant Argos would never be forgotten, she took his 100 bright eyes and put them on the tail of a peacock, her favorite bird. The eyes could no longer see, but they looked gorgeous, and that went to the peacock's little head and made him the vainest of all animals. Pursued by the gadfly, Io ran all over Greece. Trying to escape from its tormenting sting, she jumped across the strait that separates Europe from Asia Minor, and ever since has been called the Bosphorus, the cow ford. But still the gadfly chased her all the way to the land of Egypt. When the Egyptians saw the snow-white cow, they fell to their knees and worshipped her. She became an Egyptian goddess, and Hera now permitted Zeus to change her back to human shape. But first, he had to promise never to look at Io again. Io lived long as the goddess queen of Egypt, and the son she bore to Zeus became king after her. Her descendants returned to Greece as great kings and beautiful queens. Poor Io's sufferings had not all been in vain.
Hephaestus, the god of smiths and fire, was the son of Zeus and Hera. He was a hard-working, peace-loving god, and was very fond of his mother. Often he tried to soothe her temper with gentle words. Once he had even dared to step between his quarreling parents. He sided with Hera, and that made Zeus so angry that he seized his son by the legs and flung him out of Olympus. For a whole day, Hephaestus hurled through the air. In the evening he fell on the island of Lemnos with a thump so hard that the island shook. Thetis, a gentle sea goddess, found him all broken and bruised. She bound his wounds and nursed him back to health. Zeus forgave him, and Hephaestus returned to Olympus. But ever after, he walked like a flickering flame. His body was big and strong, and his hands were wonderfully skilled, but his weak legs could not support him for long. He built for himself 2 robots of gold and silver to help him about. They had mechanical brains and could think for themselves. They even could speak with their tongues of silver. They also served him as helpers in his workshop on Olympus. It was there that Hephaestus made the 12 golden thrones of the gods and their marvelous weapons, chariots, and jewels. He also had forges inside volcanoes on Earth. His helpers there were the one-eyed Cyclops. They worked his bellows and swung his heavy hammers. When Hephaestus was at work, the din of the hammers could be heard for miles, and sparks flew out of the top of the mountains. All the Olympian gods were fond of Hephaestus and often went to his forge to admire his work. When Aphrodite, his lovely wife, came to his workshop to look at the matchless jewels he was fashioning for her, she daintily lifted her trailing garments out of the soot.
Aphrodite, the beautiful goddess of love, was the only Olympian who had neither mother nor father. Nobody knew from where she had come. The west wind had first seen her in the pearly light of dawn as she rose out of the sea on a cushion of foam. She floated lightly over the gentle waves and was so lovely to behold, the wind almost lost its breath. With soft puffs, he flew her to the flowering island of Cythera, where the three graces welcomed her ashore. The three graces, goddesses of beauty, became her attendants. They dressed her in shimmering garments, bedecked her with sparkling jewels, and placed her in a golden chariot drawn by white doves. Then they led her to Olympus, where all the gods rejoiced in her beauty, seated her on a golden throne, and made her one of them. Zeus was afraid that the gods would fight over the hand of Aphrodite, and to prevent it, he quickly chose a husband for her. He gave her to Hephaestus, the steadiest of the gods, and he, who could hardly believe in his good luck, used all his skills to make the most lavish jewels for her. He made her a girdle of finely wrought gold and wove magic into the filigree work. That was not very wise of him, for when she wore her magic girdle, no one could resist her, and she was all too irresistible already. Aphrodite had a mischievous little son whose name was Eros. He darted about with a bow and a quiver full of arrows. They were arrows of love, and he delighted in shooting them into the hearts of unwary victims. Whoever was hit by one of his arrows fell head over heels in love with the first person he saw, while Eros laughed mockingly. Once a year, Aphrodite returned to Cythera and dived into the sea from which she had come. Sparkling and young, she rose from the water as dewy fresh as on the day when she had first been seen. She loved gaiety and glamour, and was not at all pleased at being the wife of sooty, hard-working Hephaestus. She would rather have had his brother Ares for her husband.
Ares, god of war, was tall and handsome, but vain, and as cruel as his brother Hephaestus was kind. Eris, the spirit of strife, was his constant companion. Eris was sinister and mean, and her greatest joy was to make trouble. She had a golden apple that was so bright and shiny, everybody wanted to have it. When she threw it among friends, their friendship came to a rapid end. When she threw it among enemies, war broke out. For the golden apple of Eris was an apple of discord. When Ares heard the clashing of arms, he grinned with glee, put on his gleaming helmet, and leapt into his war chariot. Brandishing his sword like a torch, he rushed into the thick of battle, not caring who won or lost, as long as much blood was shed. A vicious crowd followed at his heels, carrying with them pain, panic, famine, and oblivion. Once in a while, Ares himself was wounded. He was immortal, but he could not bear to suffer pain, and screamed so loudly that he could be heard for miles. Then he would run home to Olympus, where Zeus, in disgust, called him the worst of his children, and told him to stop his howling. His wounds, treated with the ointment of the gods, quickly healed, and Ares returned as good as ever, and seated himself on his throne, tall, handsome, and boastful, the plume on his golden helmet nodding proudly. Aphrodite admired him for his splendid looks, but none of the other gods were fond of him, least of all his half-sister Athena. She loathed his vain strutting and senseless bloodshed.
Athena, the goddess of wisdom, was the favorite child of Zeus. She had sprung fully grown out of her father's head. Her mother was Metis, goddess of prudence, the first wife of Zeus. He depended on her, for he needed her wise counsel. But Mother Earth warned him that were Metis to bear him a son, this son would dethrone him as Zeus had dethroned Cronus, his father, who had dethroned his own father, Uranus. This must not happen, thought Zeus, but he could not do without her advice, so he decided to swallow her. Slyly, he proposed that they play a game of changing shapes, and Metis, forgetting her prudence, playfully turned herself into all kinds of animals, big and small. Just as she had taken on the shape of a little fly, Zeus opened wide his mouth, took a deep breath, and zip, he swallowed the fly. Ever after, Metis sat in his head and guided him from there. Now it happened that Metis was going to have a daughter, and she sat inside Zeus's head hammering out a helmet and weaving a splendid robe for the coming child. Soon Zeus began to suffer from pounding headaches and cried out in agony. All the gods came running to help him, and skilled Hephaestus grasped his tools and split open his father's skull. Out sprang Athena, wearing the robe and the helmet, her gray eyes flashing. Thunder roared, and the gods stood in awe. Athena's constant companion was Nike, the spirit of victory. With Nike at her side, Athena led armies, but only those that fought for just causes. In time of peace, she stood behind the artists of Greece and taught them the fine and useful arts. She had great pride in her own skills at the loom and the potter's wheel, but was happy to see her pupils excel as long as they showed her proper respect. One of her pupils was Arachne, a simple country girl who was wonderfully skilled at the loom. People came from far and wide to admire her weavings. Stupidly, she boasted that she had learned nothing from Athena, indeed, that she was better than the goddess. That hurt Athena's pride. Disguised as an old woman, she went to the girl and tried to talk some sense into her. "Your work is beautiful," she said. "But why compare yourself with the gods? Why not be content to be the best among mortals? Let the goddess Athena herself come and measure her skill against mine," Arachne answered haughtily. Angrily, Athena threw off her disguise and stood before the girl in all her glory. "Vain girl," she said, "you may have your wish. Sit down at your loom and let us compete." Athena wove the most beautiful tapestry ever seen. Every thread and knot was perfect, and the colors sparkled. It pictured the Olympian gods in all their glory and majesty. Arachne's tapestry was also beautifully woven. Athena herself had to admit that the girl's craftsmanship was flawless. But what kind of picture had she woven? An irreverent scene making fun of Zeus and his wives. In a wrath, the goddess tore the tapestry to shreds and struck the girl with the shuttle. Immediately Arachne felt her head shrink almost to nothing. Her nimble fingers changed into long, spindly legs. Athena had turned her into a spider. "Vainglorious girl, go on and spin your thread and weave your empty net forever," said Athena to Arachne the spider. Athena was a just goddess, but she could be very stern. She knew that the gods were great only as long as they were properly worshipped by mortals. Athena was very fond of a certain city in Greece, and so was her uncle, Poseidon. Both of them claimed the city, and after a long quarrel they decided that the one who could give it the finest gift should have it. Leading a procession of citizens, the two gods mounted the Acropolis, the flat-topped rock that crowned the city. Poseidon struck the cliff with his trident, and a spring welled up. The people marveled, but the water was salty as the sea that Poseidon ruled, and not very useful. Then Athena gave the city her gift. She planted an olive tree in a crevice on the rock. It was the first olive tree the people had ever seen. Athena's gift was judged the better of the two, for it gave food, oil, and wood, and the city was hers. From her beautiful temple on top of the Acropolis, Athena watched over Athens, her city, with the wise owl, her bird, on her shoulder. And under her leadership, the Athenians grew famous for their arts and crafts.
Poseidon, lord of the sea, was a moody and violent god. His fierce blue eyes pierced the haze, and his sea-blue hair streamed out behind him. He was called the Earthshaker, for when he struck the ground with his trident, the earth trembled and split open. When he struck the sea, waves rose mountain high, and the winds howled, wrecking ships and drowning those who lived on the shores. But when he was in a calm mood, he would stretch out his hand and still the sea and raise new lands out of the water. In the days of Cronus and the Titans, the sea was ruled by Nereus, the son of Mother Earth, and Pontus the Seas. Nereus was an old sea god with a long gray beard and a fish tail, and was the father of 50 sea nymphs, the lovely Nereids. When Poseidon the Olympian came to take over the kingdom of the sea, kind old Nereus gave him his daughter, Amphitrite, for his queen, and retired to an underwater grotto. He gave the new king and queen his palace at the bottom of the sea. It was made of the palest gold and lay in a garden of corals and shimmering pearls. There Amphitrite lived contentedly, surrounded by her 49 Nereid sisters. She had an only son whose name was Triton. He had a fish tail instead of legs, like his grandfather Nereus, and rode about on the back of a sea monster trumpeting on a conch shell. Poseidon was rarely at home. He was a restless god and loved to race the waves with his team of snow-white horses. It was said that he had created the horse in the shape of breaking waves. Like his brother Zeus, Poseidon had many wives and many children, but Amphitrite was not jealous like Hera. One of the islands that Poseidon raised out of the sea was Delos. It was so newly created that it was still floating about on the water. The little island was barren. Nothing grew on it yet except a single palm tree. In its shade, the two great gods, Apollo and Artemis, were to be born. Zeus had married the goddess Leto, and when Hera found out that Leto was expecting twins, she flew into a jealous rage and ordered all the lands of the world to refuse Leto's shelter. Chased away from every land, poor Leto wandered from place to place and could not rest to give birth to her twins. At last she came to Delos, and the little island welcomed her. Since it was still floating and not quite land, it was free from Hera's bidding. Exhausted, Leto sank down in the shade of the palm tree, but still she could not give birth to her twins, for Hera forbade Aletheia, the goddess of childbirth, to go to her. Without her help, no child could be born. All the other goddesses felt sorry for Leto and tried to sway Hera by offering her a beautiful necklace. It was 9 yards long, made of gold and amber, and Hera could not resist it. She let Aletheia go, and Iris whisked her down the rainbow to Leto. Leto's first child was Artemis, a girl as beautiful as the moon, with hair as dark as the night. She was to be goddess of the hunt and all the newborn creatures. Then Apollo came into the world. He was fair as the sun, and he was to be the god of music, light, and reason. Zeus was filled with joy at the sight of his beautiful twins, and he gave them each a silver bow and a quiver full of arrows. The arrows of Artemis were as soft as moonbeams and brought painless death. Those of Apollo were hard and piercing as the rays of the sun. Zeus blessed the little island and fastened it to the bottom of the sea. Grass and flowers burst forth from the barren ground, and Delos became the richest of all the Greek isles. Pilgrims flocked to it and loaded it with temples and treasures to honor Leto and her twins. Apollo grew rapidly, as all gods did, and when he was full grown, Zeus sent him off in a chariot drawn by white swans to win for himself the Oracle of Delphi. No place in Greece was as sacred as Delphi on the steep slopes of Mount Parnassus. Sulphurous fumes rose from a deep cleft in the mountainside. A sibyl, the priestess of Delphi, sat on a tripod over the cleft, and the vapors put her into a magic sleep. In her dreams, the sibyl heard the voice of Mother Earth coming up from the depths, and repeated the mystic word she heard. Priests stood around the Sibyl and explained the meanings of her muttered prophecies to the pilgrims who had come to the Oracle of Delphi to learn about their future. The Oracle was guarded by the darksome dragon Python, who lay coiled around the sacred place. Old age had made him mean and so ill-tempered that the nymphs fled from the sacred springs nearby and the birds no longer dared to sing in the trees. The Oracle had warned Python that Leto's son would one day destroy him. He had tried to devour Leto when she wandered about looking for a place to give birth to her children, but she had escaped. When the old black dragon saw radiant Apollo flying toward him in his golden chariot, he knew that his last hour had come. But he sold his life dearly. He unleashed his fury, spitting fire and venom, and his black scaly body did not stop its writhing and coiling until Apollo had shot him with 1,000 of his silver shafts. In torrents did the dragon's venom flow down the mountainside, and the Oracle of Delphi was Apollo's. Now there was light and joy on the once somber slopes of Mount Parnassus. The air was filled with sweet tunes as the birds of the sky and the nymphs of the sacred spring returned to sing Apollo's praise. The voice of the young god rose above all the others, for he was also the god of music.
Artemis, as a newborn goddess, went to her father Zeus and asked him to grant her a wish. She wanted to remain forever a wild young maiden hunting through the woods, and she asked him to promise never to make her marry. Zeus consented, and then she asked him for 50 fleet nymphs as companions and a pack of lop-eared hounds to hunt with. Her father gave her all she asked, and she caught herself 4 hinds with golden antlers and harnessed them to her silver chariot. When the moon's magic light shone over echoing hills and wooded valleys, Artemis hunted with the nymphs and her hounds. After a wild hunt, the goddess loved to bathe in a quiet pool. Woe to the mortal who happened to see her then. One night, quite by chance, a young hunter whose name was Actaeon came upon the pool in the woods where Artemis and her nymphs were bathing. He should have taken to his heels and run for his life, but instead he stood spellbound by the sight of the goddess. Artemis was furious. While the nymphs flung a tunic over her shoulders, the goddess dipped her hand into the pool and threw a handful of water at Actaeon. The moment the silvery drops touched his forehead, antlers sprouted, and rapidly all of Actaeon changed into a stag. His own hounds leaped at him, and to his horror, he could not utter a human sound to call them off. They brought him down, never knowing that the deer was their own master. "No mortal shall live to boast that he has seen Artemis bathing," said the goddess. And she picked up her bow and arrow and went on hunting with her nymphs. Artemis was a cold and pitiless goddess. Apollo and Artemis, though different as day and night, were very fond of each other, and they both adored their mother. No one could say a belittling word about gentle Leto without arousing the wrath of her twins. There was a queen of Thebes whose name was Niobe. She was beautiful, and she was rich, and she was blessed with 14 children. Zeus himself was her grandfather, and she was very proud. "Why worship Leto?" she said to her people. "Build me a temple and worship me in her stead. I have 7 sons and 7 daughters, while she has only 1 of each." When Apollo and Artemis heard this, they grew very angry. Niobe's disrespect could not go unpunished. Apollo shot his hard arrows at Niobe's 7 sons. By no fault of their own, they were torn from life in the prime of their youth. Then Artemis let fly her painless shafts at the 7 daughters. Quietly, they lay down on their beds and died. Niobe's proud heart was broken. She wept for so long that the gods at last took pity on her and changed her into an unfeeling rock. Still inside the rock, a spring welled up, and water like tears trickled down the face of the hard stone. Apollo had many wives, but Zeus kept his promise to Artemis and never made her marry. Only once she promised her hand to a suitor, but that was a promise she had no intention of keeping. The suitor was Otus, a gigantic son of Poseidon. Otus and his brother Ephialtes were almost 60 feet tall when they reached manhood, and still they went on growing. The gods watched them with concern, for an oracle had predicted that neither gods nor mortals could kill the giant brothers. Mother Earth, however, watched them with pleasure. She was still angry with Zeus for keeping her sons, the Titans, in Tartarus, and she hoped that Otus and Ephialtes could grow big enough to overthrow him. One night, as the brothers slept with their ears to the ground, they heard Mother Earth whisper that such tall and handsome youths should not let themselves be ruled by Zeus. That was just what they had been thinking themselves, for they were vain, as many strong people are. They pulled up mountains, piled them on top of each other, and built a vast new mountain as high as Olympus. From the top, they called to Zeus to surrender his powers to them and move out of his palace with the other Olympians. Artemis could stay and become his bride, shouted Otus, and Ephialtes would take Hera. The two goddesses tossed their head with scorn, and Zeus, in a fury, hurled thunderbolts at the ruffians. Zeus's thunderbolts glanced off harmlessly, and when Ares rushed out to fight them, they grabbed him and crammed him into a bronze jar and clamped the lid shut. For once, Zeus was really worried. But Apollo, the god of reason, said that if no one could kill them, they must be tricked into killing each other. He persuaded Artemis to pretend that she was in love with Otus. Otus smirked when Apollo called to him that Artemis thought so much of him. She had accepted his proposal and would wait for him on the island of Naxos. That made Ephialtes jealous. Why hadn't Hera fallen in love with him? Wasn't he as handsome as his brother? But he swallowed his pride and went to Naxos with his brother to meet the bride. When Artemis saw the two brothers arriving, she quickly changed herself into a white deer and ran across their path. She darted to and fro between them, and the brothers, who were eager huntsmen, threw their javelins at the deer. Cleverly, she dodged, and the brothers fell to the ground, pierced by each other's javelins. Neither gods nor mortals could kill the giant brothers, but now they had put an end to each other, and were thrown into Tartarus, tied back to back with writhing snakes. All the gods thanked Artemis for saving them, and pulled Ares out of the jar where he had been crouching all the while, howling and screaming.
Orion was another giant son of Poseidon, but unlike Otus and Ephialtes, he was modest. He was a great hunter. No beast could escape from his club and jeweled sword, but he never forgot to praise Artemis as the greatest of all hunters. One day, Orion, who could walk on water as if it were land, came to the island of Chios. The island was infested with lions, wolves, and boars, who roared and howled so loudly at night that the king of Chios could not sleep. He promised Orion the hand of his daughter if he could rid the island of all the wild beasts. The king's daughter was beautiful, her father's greatest treasure, and Orion hunted as never before. Soon there was not a wild beast left. But the king did not want to part with his daughter, and claimed that he could still hear the howling of wolves at night. Orion grew angry and threatened to carry off the princess, but the king soothed him with honeyed words, sent for wine, and filled his cup so often that Orion drank too much and fell asleep. Stealthily, the evil king crept up and put out both his eyes. Now see if you can carry off my daughter, he said. Blind and helpless, Orion left Chios and staggered over the seas in search of the sun, which he knew could restore his eyesight. But he could not find his way. From afar he heard the Cyclops hammering, and he followed the sound until he came to Hephaestus' forge on the island of Lemnos. The kind god took pity on him and lent him a Cyclops boy to show him the way to the east. With the Cyclops on his shoulder to see for him, Orion walked on till he met the rising sun. The sun let its healing rays play over Orion's blind eyes, and his sight was restored. Then he rushed back to seek revenge on the false king. But when he arrived, the palace was empty, for the king had seen his huge, menacing shape against the sky and fled with his daughter. Again Orion went hunting, and soon forgot the king and the beautiful princess. He walked from island to island, and after a while he came to the island of Crete. There he met the goddess Artemis. She was glad to see him, for he could hunt as well as she, and was so very modest about it. Together they hunted wild goats and rejoiced in each other's company. Orion was the only man Artemis had ever favored, and her brother Apollo grew jealous. One day, while Artemis was away, he sent an enormous scorpion to attack Orion. Orion's club and mighty sword were no avail against the scorpion's poisonous tail. He turned to flee, but as he did, the giant insect stung his heel. Artemis was angry with her brother when she returned and found her companion dead. But she could not stay angry with her twin for long, and he helped her hang Orion's image in the sky as a constellation, so the great hunter would never be forgotten. Over the stormy winter sea, the constellation of Orion glitters enormous and menacing, and the dark clouds flee before him like wild animals. But in summer, when the constellations of the scorpion rises over the horizon, Orion begins to sway and stagger, and then he, in turn, flees and disappears into the ocean.
Hermes, merriest of the Olympians, was the god of shepherds, travelers, merchants, thieves, and all others who lived by their wits. His mother, Maia, a Titan's daughter, lived in a cave on lofty Mount Syena, a cave so deep that Hera never knew that Maia was one of Zeus's wives. Maia had therefore borne her son Hermes in peace. Hermes was very precocious, even for a god. His mother had hardly wrapped him and put him into a basket when he began to think of mischief. As soon as she had fallen asleep, he wiggled out of his wrappings and tiptoed out of the cave. In the dark of night, he toddled straight to the pasture, where Apollo kept a large herd of white cows. Apollo liked music better than cows, and he did not even notice that Hermes stole into the pasture and picked out the 50 best cows. To keep Apollo from knowing who had stolen his herd and which way they had been driven, Hermes slyly wrapped the hooves of the cows with bark to disguise their prints, and tied brooms to their tails so they would erase their own tracks. To confuse Apollo even further, he drove the cows backward out of the pasture and tied bundles of branches to his own little feet so it looked as if a giant had led something into the pasture, but nothing out. He hurried home to Mount Cyllene and hid the stolen cows in a grove. Two of them he sacrificed to the 12 Olympian gods, not forgetting to include himself as the 12th. Then he took the entrails of the sacrificed cows, made 7 strings of them, and strung them tautly across an empty tortoise shell. When he plucked the strings, they made lovely music. He had invented the first lyre. Pleased with himself, he hid the lyre under his arm and tiptoed back into the cave. He climbed into his basket, closed his eyes, and pretended to be sound asleep. But he did not fool his mother. She knew what he had been up to. "Shame on you," she said, "sneaking out at night and stealing Apollo's cows." "Why, mother," said Hermes, "I did what I had to do for you and for me. We don't want to live in this dark cave forever. Soon I will be seated on high Olympus as one of the 12 great gods, and you too will live there in glory as my mother." Then he pulled out his lyre and played his mother to sleep with a lullaby. At dawn, Apollo stormed into the cave where Hermes lay in his basket pretending to be asleep. But Apollo wasn't fooled. An oracle had told him who had stolen his herd, and he jerked little Hermes out of his crib and commanded him to return the cows at once. "How could I have stolen your cows?" Hermes whimpered. "I am only a newborn babe. I don't even know what a cow is. Look for yourself and you can see that there is not a single cow hidden in this cave." "You are not only a thief but a liar as well," raged Apollo, and chased Hermes out of the cave and straight up to Olympus. All the gods burst out laughing when they saw innocent-looking little Hermes running with furious Apollo at his heels. "Tell this thief and liar to give me back my cows at once," said Apollo to their father, Zeus. "Tell my big brother to stop bullying me. I am a newborn and a helpless infant." "I am not a liar," said Hermes. "There isn't a cow in my mother's cave." "If they are not in the cave, then show Apollo where they are," said Zeus, and hid a smile on his beard. He was proud of both his sons and wanted them to be friends. Hermes had to obey his father, and without any more tricks, he led his brother to the woods where the cows were hidden. Apollo forgave him, but when he counted his cows and found that two were missing, his anger flared again. Hermes had expected this and quickly pulled out his lyre and began to play. Apollo listened spellbound to the beautiful sounds from the new musical instrument, and he quite forgot his anger. As the god of music, he must have the lyre, and he offered Hermes his whole herd in exchange for the instrument. Hermes drove a hard bargain, and Apollo had to give him his magic wand as well. From then on, the two brothers were the best of friends. Never again did Hermes steal, though he was the god of thieves. He never told a lie, but he didn't always tell the whole truth. His mother, Maia, had no further reasons to be ashamed of him. As the mother of one of the 12 great Olympians, she moved up with him to the glory of Olympus. Zeus was so delighted with Hermes' ready wit that he made him the herald of the gods. He gave him a golden hat with wings, a pair of winged sandals, and a cape under which he could hide his magic tricks. In a flash, he could move from place to place. He put glib words in the tongues of politicians and helped merchants close good bargains. He was as popular among mortals as he was among the gods. Even Hera was fond of him. She had been really angry with him only once, and that was when he had killed her 100-eyed servant, Argus. Then she was so furious that she demanded he be punished, and called all the great and minor gods to sit in council and judge him. Each god was given a pebble, and told to cast his vote according to his decision. Those who found Hermes guilty of a crime were to throw their pebbles at Hera's feet. Those who found him innocent were to throw their pebbles at his feet. Hermes talked well in his own defense. Was it a crime to bore someone to death, he asked? After all, that was what he had done to Argus. The gods applauded, and so many threw their votes to Hermes that he was completely buried in a heap of pebbles. Ever after, travelers put up piles of stones along the roads, and they have believed that Hermes stands inside, helping them find their way. These were the first kerns. Hermes also guided those who set off on their last voyage. He touched the eyes of a dying man with his magic wand and led him down to Hades in the underworld.
Hades, Lord of the Dead, was a gloomy god of few words. Mortals feared him so much that they did not dare mention his name, for they might attract his attention and he might send for them. Instead of Hades, they called him the Rich One, and indeed, rich he was. All the treasures in the ground belonged to him. They also called him the Hospitable One, for in his desolate underground realm, he always had room for another dead soul. Hermes guided the souls of the dead down to the brink of the River Styx, a murky